This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Dr. Brad Clark, thanks for taking the time to talk with Experiment Q and welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me on here.
So a lot of your career has been looking at some of the contamination of the environment by
persistent organic pollutants. I'll just jump in there for you.
Can you give us the technical name for it, though?
That's what that's called, yeah. So these are the sorts of chemicals that accumulate in the environment and our bodies.
And they're human-made chemicals, right?
Yeah, they're all anthropogenically made chemicals.
That was actually the word I was stumbling on there.
That was the one.
That was the word, okay. I was stumbling on, yeah. So why is this a serious environmental issue?
So some of these chemicals, they're not natural. There's not really defenses against them, and because of their unique chemical properties, they are accumulating in our bodies, primarily in the fat, and it poses a big issue when women are pregnant, and they're drawing upon their energy reserves, and the developing fetus, and also when the child's being breastfed later in life is being exposed to a toxic super synthetic chemicals.
So it actually passes through in the mother's breast milk.
Yeah. Now, for mothers out there, please don't get frightened. I mean, it's just one of the realities of modern living, and the recommendation by the World Health Organization is that you still do breastfeed because there's a lot of important nutrients being provided by breast milk. But unfortunately, due to our modern life and modern society's reliance on industrial chemicals, we all have a body burden, men and women, of chemicals in our body. Yeah, so things like pesticides, we have flame retardants all through our couches. Computers have a lot of chemicals that emit when we turn them on. So all of these things that we have made, human-made chemicals, not all of them, but some of the worst of these accumulate in our bodies, and some of the impacts are pretty shocking, actually. So cancers are an endpoint, reproductive health problems. So you do see this occurring across Western society where we have declines in male fertility, and also I think almost everybody knows someone who now is sort of struggling with fertility. And probably the most frightening one is actually impaired intelligence.
But what is the link here? Like, is it really is it a correlation, or is it actually a proven connection between the two?
Yeah, there's definitely pretty clear correlations, and also causation is one of the – we are proving that these things do cause these sorts of impacts. It depends on which chemical specifically we're talking about. But, there's over 140 million unique chemicals registered in the American Chemical Society database.
You mean humans as a race, we have developed that many chemicals?
Yeah. And there's about 150,000 that we routinely use through Western society. So it's a big, big problem facing us environmental scientists about how we monitor the environment and how we sort of prioritize chemicals that we think are of a concern.
So a lot of your research has been monitoring the environment. So, for example, looking at river streams or bodies of water and, I guess, cataloging these chemicals in those waterways, is that right?
I mean, that's part of what we do. My specialty is really about how we explain how chemicals move through the environment. We purchase the product, we use it in our domestic environment, which is unfortunately one of a very contaminated space, and then we use it in the shower, and then it'll go to wastewater treatment plant. After treatment, there's only two possible routes that it can go. One is released into either the rivers or the ocean, and the other would be that it would be applied to agricultural land, and then eventually it would probably be washed back into the rivers or surface waters anyway. Microplastics then in the environment, in the aquatic environment, fish will eat them, and most fish commercially, most fish have microplastics in their digestive system, or a large percentage, and then that's really the cycle of that when we can be exposed to these chemicals or microplastics again.
And if it's used in fertilizer, could that then be the grass is growing using that fertilizer and the cows can eat that? Is that also how it comes into our body?
Yeah, that's also another pathway, yeah. Right. Plant uptake grazing animal accumulation. These are pathways we need to consider when we model the movement of the chemicals. It's important for when we develop legislation around contaminant guidelines in water and soil and things like that. So we need to be able to predict how we think that this chemical will behave in the environment, and then how potentially humans are exposed to these chemicals through natural processes.
So if there are so many of these chemicals, though, how can we possibly look at them all and say, this is the action we need to take on these chemicals? Or are they kind of grouped into similar type of chemicals that we can say, this type of chemical we need to either not use, or if we use it, we have to use it in this way?
Yeah. I mean, at the moment, we're facing a losing battle. And I'll use bisphenol A as an example, which a lot of people are probably familiar with.
What's the common name for that?
BPA.
Okay, yes. So, that's like in your water bottles that you might use for the gym.
And a lot of people these days are looking for, oh, yeah, I want BPA free. That's all they know. They heard BPA is bad. The problem is that we actually know a lot about BPA. We actually know about how it interacts with the human body. It's been replaced. There's another chemical in that water bottle now, but we don't know what it is, and we don't know what it's going to do either. So, and then you apply that same sort of story across every type of chemicals we're dealing with, and it becomes a recurring story. I'll use another example as well, which is the firefighting foams that a lot of communities have been had their drinking water supply contaminated with. But this firefighting foam was used on Defence Force sites regularly for quite a number of decades, and it seeped into the groundwater supplies. And airports are also another source of this chemical. We have regulations on one of them. Now, what the chemical industry has done is now produced a family of over 4,000 different types of fluorinated chemical. So, it's a real big challenge for us as environmental scientists. We're always on the back foot. So, what we need to do is actually change regulation.
What's the responsibility of companies and organizations who are developing these chemicals? Is it basically they develop something and then it's regulators' responsibility to come up and test them and find out whether they're safe or not?
Yeah, well, historically what it has been is been if because also there's commercial confidence as well. So sometimes we don't even know what's in a product,
right?
You know, and it's a commercial trade secret, and we also don't have a framework where we say that the protection of human health and the environment from chemicals is really the first priority. So normally what happens is the industry just produces whatever they want. And then there'll be a lag time where it will accumulate in the environment and potentially our bodies. And then we will we'll have gathered enough evidence to say, yeah, we think that this chemical is problematic and it should be banned. But that could be, say, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So the fluorinated chemicals were first introduced in 1950, you know, and for the last 50 years or 70, they've been accumulating in our bodies and causing all sorts of human health impacts.
And then even if they do decide that it is harmful, then they replace it with something else that we don't know what the impacts are.
Yeah. So then we start the cycle over again. So really what we need to do is move to almost an approach similar to pharmaceuticals, where the burden of proof lies with the chemical manufacturer to prove that it doesn't accumulate in the human body, that it will break down in the environment, and that it's non-toxic. It doesn't sound like a conceptually big deal, but that is the way we need to move forward in the Western world to change our attitude to chemical management. I think microplastics is another really interesting example where multinationals are getting away with scot-free. So a lot of people heard about microplastics, and if you're walking along the beach one day and you kick up the seaweed on the strand line, you'll find some, they're called production pellet nodules. You'll see them on the beach everywhere. It doesn't matter where you are, you'll find them.
Can you say that again?
Nurdles.
Nurdles?
Yeah.
What are nurdles?
So if you want to make anything out of a plastic, you'll get these. They're about 2 to 3 mils in size, and then they'll melt them down to make whatever they want to make. And you can order them on eBay. They come in all sorts of colors and different types of polymer.
So you can use it in one of those 3D printers, for example.
I think so, yeah, yep. I don't know how, but they find themselves all through the environment, you know. So at some point between the manufacturer and also then making a new product, they find their way to the environment. But the worst part was when the beauty companies started putting microplastics into cosmetics. Now, this is just a really, really stupid idea because, I mean, a lot of people don't really think about what happens to the water they use in their home after they use it. but we have to treat that, and we have to treat all of the chemicals that are in it. And eventually it has to be released back to the environment. That water and also the solids that are produced have to be released back to the environment.
And these microplastics, they're too small to filter out in that process of treatment of water.
Yeah, well, they can be. So effluent can be one of the sources. And also then we have this residual solid sludge basically that historically in Australia has been used as a fertilizer for in agriculture. Now, it's a really good fertilizer. It's fantastic, and it's really important for us to cycle nutrients because eventually we're going to run out of phosphorus too. But now we have a situation where that material is probably unusable because companies acted recklessly and added polymer unnecessarily to something we're going to put down the drain. Like, we don't need to have polyethylene in our facial scrubs. We don't need it in our toothpaste either. And these are some of the products they're putting it in.
And but this has been banned in the United States, yeah, using this, hasn't it?
There's been bans on this. But again, it's the same thing. One type of polymer got banned.
And so you're saying a different type of polymer has been now being used in the States?
Potentially, right. Yeah.
And in Australia, is it banned?
There was a moratorium on it. So I've been into supermarkets and I can still find these products.
How do you identify it if you pick up a bottle of facial
just
cream?
You just look on the back and, well, this is the thing. Now some of the names are changing, a bit more complicated. But if it lists polyethylene or polypropylene, then that's plastic that you're seeing in, you know, the little beads inside the facial scrub or the body wash or whatever you want to buy.
Because I think this is one of the things that astounded me, is that these microplastics and chemicals are found all across the world, even like in the most remote places where you wouldn't expect human impact on the environment, but they're found here.
Oh, yeah. They're everywhere. These chemicals are in Antarctica, the Arctic. In fact, some of the worst contamination is occurring in the Arctic, accumulating things like the polar bears who, you know, they don't eat for 3 months, right? They're really relying on their fat reserves. And there's been some devastating impacts of some marine mammals and also some of the biota up in the Arctic.
So you kind of mentioned before that it's kind of a losing battle. We're always one step behind.
It does feel this way, but you've got to keep optimistic.
So what is the optimistic view of this? I mean, if it's already in the environment, how can we combat it, or how can we fix it at all? Or is it just a matter of stopping it now and just stopping the progress of this?
I think any opportunity we get to talk about this is an opportunity to talk about the regulation that needs to happen. And again, it's a conceptual shift where the burden of proof becomes on the producer to demonstrate that it doesn't cause harm. So we can learn from it and we can move forward from it. But, you know, there's all sorts of environmental examples where we're not really doing the right thing just yet.
Of course. But yeah. For this example, is there anything we can do about the stuff that's currently in the environment, or is that just too late?
Well, we'll have to remediate it all, yeah. So, and then it'll come with a huge cost. It's a very good question about how we clean up the environment now. And there's going to be a background of anthropogenically produced chemicals that we'll have to deal with for at least a generation, probably longer. You know, you add this to climate change and nuclear reactors, and we are really one of the most selfish generation of people that have ever lived. But because someone's going to have to deal with this at some point, these chemicals.
What do you personally do about this? Like, do you check what you're buying in the supermarkets? Do you avoid certain things? What do you personally do?
I mean, in the environment movement years ago, there was a lot of emphasis based on putting the individual in charge of what they bring into their home. I just think it's too complicated, and I think it's an unfair burden because I've been studying chemicals my whole life, essentially, and I just can't imagine, like, how someone would go about deciding which chemicals that they think is acceptable, you know, from the supermarket. So really, and I think a lot of people have this attitude, and I think it's fair enough, that the government should really be thinking about which chemicals are safe for the population to be exposed to. So I try to avoid things like plastics as much as possible, so ceramics, and have glass. The lining on your fry pan can be a fluorinated chemical that can be problematic, so maybe get cast iron or those sorts of things. So wherever possible, natural products is what I try to do. Yeah, sometimes you just can't do anything about it. I mean, and we're probably, you know, we've managed to survive and grow even despite all of this chemical contamination. Essentially, we're playing a bit of an experiment with all of humanity at this point.
So how do you identify under the LGBTIQA+ umbrella?
Gay, I guess. Yeah. It's a term that I don't really feel very strongly about. Yeah.
In terms of you don't need to identify using that term?
I just don't feel I get the word. I feel uncomfortable about it. Yeah. Okay. But that's the word that makes other people can understand the lifestyle I lead, I guess.
So I heard that you recently came out in a lecture.
I did. So there's a lot of push on diversity in the university sector, and I'm in the School of Chemistry. I've always operated in like chemistry or engineering sort of research circles, and they tend to be really straight environments. So I think the technically correct term is probably heteronormative sort of environments. And historically, the first generation of academics in Australia were white men. And these white men typically had their academic positions soon after they did their PhD. So it's a very different and privileged environment that they operated in when you compare it to, you know, I'm sure there's PhD candidates listening now, and it's a rough, rough path that they're going to go down if they want to become academics.
But what was your reasoning or your motivation to do that? Was it to try and show students that it's okay to be a non-straight person studying in this field?
Yeah, it was about that. As a research active academic, I don't really have any role models that I could look to. And it was about and I wanted to talk to this. So it was really about saying to the students, hey, there are some gay faculty members here and it's not a big deal. And well, it is and it isn't, because it affects your everyday experiences as a researcher. And, you know, so if that's the path you want to take, that there are other people that have done it. In the world that I exist in my research world, it's very straight. I feel like sometimes, you know, when I've done my postdoc in England with this professor, I told him I was gay, and then he told me I wasn't.
Really?
He thought I was having this elaborate joke with him. And I'm like, nah, I got a partner and we live together and, you know, Nick, he'll be coming along too. It was the strangest sort of experience for 5-10 minutes. It was like, he just thought it was a joke. And I'm like, it's an odd thing to be joking about. But anyway, but we're really good friends now. And I think quite possibly I was the first openly gay person that he'd ever met.
And did you get any feedback or anything from coming out in your lecture?
Oh, people were like, oh, that's all right, blah, blah, blah. Again, it was more about the whole workshop was meant to be about diversity, inclusion, all this sort of thing. And I just wanted to make the point of a couple of things, because I don't think younger people sometimes fully understand that coming out isn't a one-off thing, particularly for professionals and, say, particularly if you've got an international career. You know, so that was really what I was talking about. That whole coming out thing is something that happens to me or to almost on a daily, weekly basis. And it becomes this decision you need to make when you're, say, dealing with the CEO of a company that you're hoping will invest in your research. How are they going to feel about me telling them that I'm gay, or am I losing opportunities for this? My experience as a gay scientist has been I've had one incident, we'll leave that one. But generally speaking, it's been nothing but positive. And I think most people would just be very matter of fact. Hey, I'm gay. I have a male partner. They always responded very positively. And I think in some ways it became an advantage, because I became the token gay of the team. You know, they got this few diversity points.
Dr. Brad Clark, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.